Hello, hello, and welcome to Arthouse Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make arthouse, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Swetman, and I'm very excited this week to bring you a discussion of the new David Cronenberg film, Crimes of the Future. It's a dark, challenging film, and to help us make sense of it, I've got two guests who are huge Cronenberg fans, filmmaker Mark Thiedemann and artist Philip Rex Huddleston. Stick around. Before we get into everything, a quick plug for the Arthouse Garage web store. The most recent addition is a new design that says, "Cinema is spiritual." Listeners to the show know that I like to talk about the connection between art and spirituality, and this new t-shirt design really reflects that theme in a cool way. And it's not just a t-shirt, you can order it on a hoodie, or a coffee mug, or a tote bag, or a number of other things. To check it out for yourself, go to arthousegarage.com/shop, or find a link in the show notes. Let's get into today's film. Director David Cronenberg has been making movies since the late 60s, and he's earned a reputation for creating strange, grotesque films that often feature some intense body horror. Not all of his films fit that description, but the one we are discussing today, Crimes of the Future, certainly does. Cronenberg is best known for films like The Fly, Videodrome, Scanners, Dead Ringers, A History of Violence, Eastern Promises, and Crash. To be clear, that's not the Crash that won Best Picture in 2004. It's the Crash from 1996 about people who are sexually attracted to car accidents. So if you're unfamiliar with Cronenberg, those are the vibes. Crimes of the Future is his latest film, starring Viggo Mortensen, Lea Seydoux, and Kristen Stewart. In today's discussion, we don't give a whole lot of context for what the film is about, so I'll try to do that here. Crimes of the Future is set in a strange, futuristic version of Earth in which human evolution has started to progress. Some people have stopped feeling pain altogether, and a few have begun to grow new organs. Viggo Mortensen plays Saul Tenser. He's one of the people growing new organs. He seems to have many physical ailments, and he uses a handful of complex and bizarre medical chairs and beds. He and his partner Clarice are performance artists. Whenever he has grown a new organ, they put on a show in which Clarice, a former surgeon, operates on Saul in front of an audience and removes the organ from his body. It's pretty wild. In this world, there's also a bureaucratic organization in charge of registering new organs. That's where Kristen Stewart works. There are also other performance artists doing similar types of shows, and there are the police who are trying to shut all of this down. The film is strange, violent, erotic, and thought-provoking, and there's so much going on that it's a little bit difficult to make sense of it all. That's where this week's guests come in. Mark Thiedemann is an Arkansas filmmaker and a lecturer in UCA's film program. I've seen a handful of his films, and I am a big fan of all of them. I've linked to Mark's Vimeo page in the show notes, so you can check some of those out yourself. Philip Rex Huddleston is an artist and a literary theory enthusiast, and as you'll hear, quite a thoughtful watcher of cinema. You can see Philip's work at his website, philiprexhuddleston.com, and there is a link to that in the show notes as well. As you will also hear in the discussion, both Mark and Philip are big fans of David Cronenberg, and I'm so grateful to them for coming on the show for this film. I definitely had some thoughts after watching Crimes of the Future, but my Cronenberg knowledge is pretty limited, so I'm glad I got some more experienced minds on the show to break this one down. As far as spoilers go, we don't spoil any of the film's surprises until the very end of the podcast, and I do give a spoiler warning before we get into that section. So feel free to listen away and just tune out later if you haven't seen this one yet. Okay, without further ado, here is my discussion with Mark Thiedemann and Philip Rex Huddleston about David Cronenberg's Crimes of the Future.
I can feel you pulling things around in there.
It's a brand new organ. Never before seen. We've all felt that the body was empty. Empty of meaning. And we've wanted to confirm that. So so that we could fill it with meaning.
The world is a much more dangerous place now that pain has all but disappeared.
Surgery is sex, isn't it?
Is it?
You know it is. Surgery is the new sex.
I don't like what's happening with the body. In particular, what's happening with my body. Which is why I keep cutting it up. What do you think they'd find inside it?
Outer space.
Whoops. Sorry.
Let us not be afraid to map the chaos inside. Let us create a map that will guide us into the heart of darkness.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, Mark Thiedemann and Philip Huddleston. How are you today?
Great. Doing well. Yeah. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to have you on. Philip, we just met. Nice to meet you. And I'm so excited to hear your thoughts on this movie and to have you on. Mark, I've been a little bit aware of your work for a few years. And we've Facebook chatted a few times, but I thought I might take the opportunity to tell you that I'm a big fan of your films. I first saw, became aware of you at Filmland a few years ago when Dragon Slayer played, and I loved it so much. The kind of the unique tone with all this like Arkansas roadside, like the aesthetic of that with all this metal music. I was so taken with it. And then such a potent emotional story as well. And then from there sought out some of your other shorts. So I've seen Swimsuit and A Christian Boy, Cain and Abel, and Sacred Hearts, Holy Souls, all of which I really liked. It seems like there's a sort of recurring theme in your work of sort of traditional religion friction with modern life. And that's definitely something that I resonate strongly with. So I really like that about your work. So anyway, very excited to have you on the show today. And I understand you have a new film hopefully coming soon that you've wrapped recently on. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a documentary that I've been working on for the past 3-ish years. It's called Kevin. It's about a young skateboarder living in Paragould, Arkansas, who is the coolest person that I've met in many, many years. It's a story about growing up in the South, in a place that I think is often ignored and misunderstood in film. I'm really excited about it. We're just finishing up now and seeking distribution, so hopefully there will be some good news soon. And thank you also for your kind words about Dragon Slayer and the other movies. Actually, one of the reasons that you like Dragon Slayer is that music, and Philip was a big part of that as well, had a lot to do with that soundtrack. So
Well, thank you, Philip. Yeah. That's so cool. Well, yeah, I'm so excited about Kevin. Feel free whenever there's, you know, Kickstarter links or whatever, anything I can share out on Arthouse Garage socials. I would love to do that and stay in the loop about the latest with that as it gets closer. But well, let's talk about Crimes of the Future. So I originally had another guest planned and they had to drop out at the last minute. It's like, who can I find for this? And I've been wanting to have you on the podcast for a while, Mark, and saw on Letterboxd that you have some thoughts. So, oh, it's perfect. We'll get Mark. And then you said, let's get Philip as well. Some David Cronenberg experts, I think. So let's jump in. So I guess that's the first question I have is, how familiar are you with Cronenberg's other work? And are you generally a fan of his films?
Well, I'm a mega fan. I got into Cronenberg when I was in high school, and I honestly didn't know anything about him or how to interpret his films. I remember the first film that I saw of his was Crash, which is a pretty difficult movie for a 16-year-old kid to watch. It deals with some really uncomfortable truths about human sexuality and desire, and I'm not sure that I could really parse it all out at the time. But it was interesting enough to make me go and look for other works of his. The second movie that I saw of his was Dead Ringers, a classic with the great Jeremy Irons. And again, I probably saw that movie too young. I don't know that a 16-year-old can really understand the complexities of that movie. But when I watched it, I was really struck by the fact that Cronenberg seems to be able to do two things at once. First of all, he can make you really care about his characters and develop deep empathy towards them and have that classical movie experience. But also, he's such a smarty pants that he's always pulling you towards an intellectual interpretation. Mm-hmm. And when I saw Dead Ringers, I remember thinking, I didn't understand this film, but I know I liked it because it's making my mind go wild, right? And I think that that's something that we always get from Cronenberg, this invitation to conversation, this invitation to pull a movie apart, to think about the human experience. I've been a fan ever since. I love the guy. I don't think he's ever made a bad movie. Well, I don't think he's made a bad movie since he started making movies with budgets. But I deeply familiar and love him a lot.
What about you, Philip?
I come to Cronenberg through David Lynch. And so I was a big Lynch fan in high school. I got to see Mulholland Drive in theaters. I guess saw Blue Velvet on VHS way back when. And it was then that all of my friends started watching Cronenberg films together. We watched Naked Lunch was my initiation. So I got the body horror puppetry introduction to Cronenberg. And then, like Mark, Crash was one of my first. And I don't even think at the time I recognized that it was the same filmmaker. And only now does it kind of make sense, the connection. And I think there is, especially for our generation, this watching Cronenberg too early and then coming back to it retroactively and saying, okay, well, now I need a different interpretation for what in the world I was watching when I was a teenager.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I'm so glad to have you both on for this then, knowing that. So, I mean, I started doing this podcast for one thing, because I kind of came to film late. And so there's so many directors is like, oh, I know a lot about them, but I haven't seen any of their movies. And that's David Cronenberg is one of those. So I was able to watch one other in preparation for this. And I was hoping to catch a few more, but I watched Videodrome last week, which I had always wanted to, and I really loved it. And actually it has some kind of cool thematic connections to this film, I think. So I think it was a good one, but like, I've never seen The Fly. Like I wasn't allowed to watch these things growing up. And so I'm catching up with Cronenberg, but so yeah, I'm excited to have some experienced Cronenberg fans to dive into this with. So how do you feel about this film, Crimes of the Future? How does it fit into his body of work? And does it stand out in any way compared to his other films?
Well, it's the film of the year. Okay. although I'll give you a little bit of a disclaimer on that. I say that about every single movie that I see, and I probably said that about three other movies this year. I think this time I mean it. This was such an exciting movie for me. It brought us back to that golden age of gory Cronenberg films like Videodrome that you just mentioned. But I think it also shows that he as a filmmaker is very connected to the time in which he's making a movie. This film felt so now to me. It addresses so many issues that are facing us in our contemporary culture. And it shows that a filmmaker with such a unique and clear sensibility can adapt to the way that the world is changing and then repurpose his ideas as our technology grows, as our social structures change, right? I don't know. I love it. I think it's a culmination of all of the work that's come before in a lot of ways.
Interesting. What about you, Philip? Are you generally a fan of this one?
I completely agree. I think it will go down as his magnum opus. It hits the body horror themes. It has the puppetry, you know, that we all love that's built in. It has the play of desire and fantasy that kind of culminates into a sacrificial protagonist. and let alone historically, you know, it took forever to get this film made. And I don't see this not going down as the one that people say, and this kind of wrapped up everything that Cronenberg was intending to do throughout his body.
It's weird because I think we have that conversation every time Cronenberg makes a movie, right? I remember when Spider came out back in 2002, I thought to myself, this is Cronenberg with a new level of sophistication, who's addressing all of the things he's always addressed in a new and exciting way. And then the same thing happens with Cosmopolis, right? Which I think is one of the great films of the past 10 years. And then again with this movie, it's fascinating, the work that he does and the way that he kind of modulates his ideas film after film. But I'll say that I think I agree with Philip that this is the magnum opus. And also, I imagine that the next time he makes a movie, I'll probably say the same thing again, honestly.
Yeah. Well, to answer the question myself, with my very limited knowledge, I loved this movie. And it felt like it had some thematic ties with Videodrome, with, you know, violence and sex and art and kind of how those things come together and kind of having these different factions at play, was really interesting. So yeah, I definitely like this as well. And, for one of the reasons is the tone. So as thematically similar as it can be to Videodrome, and I'm sure some of his other films, stylistically, this was quite different and so dark visually and in the story as well. But how did you guys feel about the tone and the visuals of the film?
I think they're beautiful, but if you don't mind, I'd love to actually go back for a second to this idea of Cronenberg films and how this fits in. And I think style is a part of that, right? And I'd love to talk about that, but you know, with Cronenberg, I think, you know, he's the king of body horror. We all know him as the king of body horror, right? And body horror, I think, means a ton of things, right? Mostly a direct confrontation with things that we as human beings kind of disavow, right? Things that we think are ugly, and things that we would prefer to not actually have to accept about our own bodies and the way that they work. Right. And that ugliness is really a part of the style in the film. Yeah. Right. But, you know, when we think about body horror and we think about all of his work, I think there are a lot of different ways of looking at it. Horror with gore, right? All of our guts, the blood, cutting skin open, all of these kinds of things that we would prefer not to look at. All of the ugly functions that our bodies go through. Digestion, right, is a really big part of this movie. I think the most horrifying part of Crimes of the Future is watching a man eat and digest food. I mean, it's terrifying, right? But then more than that, it goes into like things like death and pain and the malfunctions of the human body. The fact that our bodies aren't perfect, that they fail us in a lot of cases. And then I think maybe more interestingly than that, the idea is the idea that he's presenting to us is that our bodies are not just biological machines. They're also social machines. And the things that our brain does and compels us to do are not only biological, but they're also informed by social structures. They're also informed by technology, and these things can lead our bodies to almost make decisions for us that are very horrifying, including decisions to do things with our own bodies or do things to the bodies of other people, right? Like with Crash, we see people so messed up that they're getting off on watching car crashes, right? Or participating in car crashes as a kind of form of erotic fascination. You know, I think about this, like, even in terms of a movie like A Dangerous Method, which I know Philip is not too much of a fan of, it's like his stately period piece, which seems to not really fit into the Cronenberg canon, right? And it's a movie about the birth of psychoanalysis, which I think is his big subject. He's super interested in psychoanalysis, not only as a subject, but also as a method of interpreting films. But with A Dangerous Method, you have this story of the birth of psychoanalysis, the story of a sort of, it's weirdly a bromance between Freud and Carl Jung. And it has at its heart this character played by Keira Knightley, who's very interested in psychoanalysis as a subject and a field of study. And she's so traumatized by events in her past that it affects her physically, right? Like, we were talking about this the other day, Philip and I, Keira Knightley's performance in this movie is totally wild. It's absolutely insane. She can't control her own body. And I think what Cronenberg is kind of getting at is because she's been through so many traumatizing things in her past, her childhood, that she's lost control of her own physicality, right? Like, she can't, like, even be contained within her own body. And even more than that, it makes her have these kind of wild desires. She wants things done to her and to her own body that are kind of horrifying. And more than that, she kind of wants to do horrifying things to other people's bodies, right? And so, like, all of this is compounded into this weird, grotesque, horrifying examination of the way that, like, our skin interacts with the world around us. And how our brains adapt and then force us to use our bodies in these ways that are kind of confusing, maybe really messed up, maybe not really messed up, depending on your perspective. And then there's the question of the freedom, you know, like, am I allowed to do these crazy messed up things based on everything that's going on? The whole canon of Cronenberg, though, is rooted, I think, in this idea that we have disavowed our own bodies and the way that they interact with the world and then force us to interact with other people. And that's totally present, obviously, in Crimes of the Future. But
I would like to extend that, that it's not only ourselves, but almost every Cronenberg has some force, some agency that is trying to create that limit on the body. I think A Dangerous Method is a good example here because it seems like it is about the bromance of Jung and Freud. And yet Keira Knightley shows up and she's almost saying, what are you going to do about this psychoanalysis? What are you going to do about the Cronenberg effect? You know, of the production of our desires through our bodies just is overwhelming. And there, you cannot place limits on it. With Videodrome, you think that this kind of radical agency, spoiler a little bit, is, you know, doing things to our minds and making us more violent, more sexual. But actually what they're doing is trying to get rid of that and place limits on the body's ability to sexualize itself and to both take in violence and cause violence, which I think Videodrome is maybe the best parallel of all of his films for Crimes of the Future. And that there is the agency that is trying to limit the way in which the body's literally producing new organs to the extent of, we're going to allow you to do this, even though we think it's a little bit outside of social expectations. Nevertheless, you're going to help us put the further limit on making sure that this aesthetic point that you're making never becomes a political point. And he brings that up in Videodrome too. He says, you know, these videos are political, and Cronenberg always kind of points to what's going on socially or intimately with a family and history of violence, or with the Batman and the limo in Cosmopolis, that there's this political social world that's going on, and are we actually having a relationship to it? I think the limit, the agency that he always plays as the limit, I think Cronenberg kind of isn't interested in as much as those special protagonists who, like Keira Knightley, try to release this, Viggo Mortensen and Crimes, releasing this Viggo Mortensen in History of Violence, trying to release this.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, there's always this sort of sense that our body is driving us towards certain desires, not only biologically, but also socially. Also, Cronenberg has this idea that technology and the body are the same thing, right? That as technology advances, our bodies adapt to it in some way. So our bodies are always doing these natural things, but you're absolutely right. There's always that opposing structure that he gives us that says what the body is doing is not right, right? Mm-hmm. So you have the agency in Videodrome, as you mentioned, or History of Violence, which is a movie about the structure of this sort of like Norman Rockwell society that says, disavow your body, you know, let's get away from our impulses. Let's just be a nice family unit, you know? And I think Crimes of the Future maybe deals with that subject in the most fascinating way. We can get to that later, but there's always that tension between society and the human body itself and all of the weird manifestations that happen around it. You know?
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to throw in one more thing before we move on. This group, this agency of like whatever it may be, its limitations on desire, limitations on the protagonist in some way, it's always moralistic. Of yes, we know you can do these things. Yes, you know, we know you could make all these porn films and Videodrome and snuff films. We know that you could, History of Violence, be actually out there, you know, a mobster and everything like that. And the whole family is kind of infected with that, to use a bodily term. I think Cronenberg makes us as the audience the moral agency usually, because doesn't the moral agency usually win out in a Cronenberg film? You know, the protagonist usually does, you know, either die or sacrifices themselves or ignores the fact that, you know, this has happened in the past. He seems to be on the side of that moral agency has to wrangle it in, or I think he has conflict with that, you know, throughout his films of what do we do with the potential for us to do as much as we possibly can with our desire. Viggo Mortensen in Crimes of the Future, he can produce new organs. This is amazing. You know, let's make a performance out of it. But you better make sure that you're putting on your performance in the correct manner, the way that we would like you to. And this better not get out of hand to the point where it's actually affecting social change.
Yeah, I like all of that a lot. And it's interesting, like I went into this expecting a little bit more of a straightforward horror movie, like Videodrome or The Fly or something. But it really felt almost like a political thriller, just with that body horror stuff in there, because we have all these factions who are saying, OK, so like the body is starting to do these things. Some saying we should embrace that. Some saying we should shut that down. And Viggo Mortensen's character, without giving anything away, is kind of straddling the line between those in a really interesting way that we'll talk about the ending in a little bit here, and maybe we can talk more about that. But yeah, I loved all that about this one. And speaking of the just kind of the tone and the style of it, one thing I wanted to mention was I love the puppetry and these complex medical beds and chairs and things, and then we have these technicians come in to fix them, and they're like fangirls almost of, oh, that's the old model we haven't seen. That was such a cool way to bring that in. Little personal connection, one of my children is a wheelchair user, and I know these people, these technicians that come fix the chair when it breaks, and so like, oh, this is a weird Cronenberg twist on that. That was just a fun connection with it. I thought visually there were some really amazing things here, like the dancing ear man and all the performance art scenes I thought were so striking and gross and all of that in the way that I expected it to be. What did you think about this film visually and kind of the tone of it compared to his other films or just in general?
Mark, I have on that note, I have a specific question for you, Mark, as a director of Mark and I talked about this, and I kind of joked that the movie, the cinematography and the visual places consistently reminded me of Dune. Of there's just this empty vastness of background that kind of has this foggy haze over it, and it doesn't really matter, don't even look at the background, you know. Let's focus in on, especially at the body performance scenes, and even to the extent of when he goes out to visit different people, whether it be at night near the boat, it's kind of okay, here's some beautiful lit color in the background or whatnot. How much of that, Mark, do you think that is, it just doesn't seem like a usual Cronenberg stylistic choice. And I was wondering why is Cronenberg doing this?
That's a really good question, and maybe I didn't notice it because I felt, I think maybe I feel the opposite of you, mm-hmm. Philip, that I felt very connected to the backgrounds of this movie. I was always noticing like a toilet that has like sort of what seems like vomit, like just sliding down the sides of it. Or the texture of these sort of capsized ships on the shore. I felt very aware of the environment, but maybe now that you say that, and you talk about throwing it into a kind of hazy dune-like mess, maybe I saw the design of this movie as being just sort of like textural, you know? Like we were talking earlier about the ugliness of Cronenberg and getting into all the guts and all of that kind of stuff. And weirdly, the backgrounds kind of look like guts. They look like as grotesque as everything that we're seeing coming out of human bodies in this movie, you know? And I think maybe to your point, Philip, other films have all seemed sleeker, right? Like there's always been like hospitals as a background or like weird teleportation devices in The Fly that almost look like Mac commercials. You know, they have this very modern quality to them. But this is the first movie that he's made where the design of the movie feels as gross as the subject of the movie. You know, with Crash, you have these like sleek cars. Here you have like Athens as a set piece and these like decaying walls and a malfunctioning classical environment. And they talk about like the classical human in the movie, right? Like the perfect mm-hmm. classical human. And here we have the perfect classical space, Athens in Greece, like the birth of like so many great things, art, philosophy, whatever, right? And here we see it all just decaying. I feel like I noticed a lot of details, Philip, but it all just sort of becomes this weird, messy, kind of grotesque textural blur also.
When he goes to when Viggo Mortensen, who's the protagonist, he goes to the guy who says, oh, well, I'm gonna put you in the Inner Beauty Awards, you know, nice little pun, you know, I'll give you the stack of damp boxes in the back, cardboard boxes, and this is it, this is the office. That one really stood out to me. I would say for somebody watching this to focus on the lack that is usually in the background, specifically in the performance scenes and the sparse set piece. To me, it identifies with, whereas Viggo Mortensen is this, it makes Viggo Mortensen even more unique because he can produce, he can create something new. He definitely is the creative force. I would even say he's an allegory for Cronenberg mm-hmm. himself, creating these films that people see as like gross and you know, like, where are these coming from? Nobody's making stuff like this. Nobody, as we constantly hear about like people who make kind of visceral, gross horror films, you know, where do they come up with that idea? You know, they have to have, you know, something messed up inside of them to be thinking these sorts of things. I think Viggo Mortensen stands out even more from this kind of dark, empty, sparse, dystopian landscape where nobody else knows what to do if it's not for these artists.
Andrew, I'm curious to know what you thought about the production design of the movie, because we don't really know a lot about where this mm-hmm. movie takes place. Like, what's going on? What has happened to the world? What, mm-hmm. like, why is there an organization called a National Organ Registry and their office has bare walls and a bookshelf and some boxes on the floor? Like, what did you make of all of that?
Yeah, well, I always love when there's like a kind of unusual world and that we still have this very grounded kind of bureaucratic stuff within it, which I always think like the Coen brothers are always laugh at bureaucracy. And so we have a little bit of that. And I think he even says, I thought she was sexy in a bureaucratic sort of way. Oh, that was a funny line. But yeah, I think I agree more with Philip about, like, I noticed how sparse it was to the point that it's ostensibly this is the future, but it's hard to say when exactly or to the point that it almost took on a fable like quality a little bit that, and that's kind of my, I guess my major reading of it was so we have, you know, these people who are sort of trying to embrace this progress that seems like the human evolution is taking on us, and people don't feel pain anymore, and people are growing their own organs, and surgery has become this thing people do in the streets, and then certain factions moralistically saying, no, we got to stop this, we have to shut this down, we can't let this spread. Feels like such a fable for what you can, any political thing today can kind of apply to that. So I felt it was more sparse, but now I want to rewatch and kind of key in more to those, the set designs and everything that you're talking about too, Mark. But yeah. Dropping in quickly to say, don't forget to check out our Patreon. The Patreon gets you ad-free episodes for the low price of $3 a month, or for just $6 a month, you can also get extended podcast episodes, bonus episodes, and videos of all the guest discussions I have on the show, like the one you're listening to now. I've had a great time with the bonus episodes as well, which are open-ended discussions of films and TV, old and new. On recent bonus episodes, we've talked about films like The Secret of Kells, the recent A24 horror film X, and TV shows like Severance, Pam and Tommy, and The After Party. Make sure to visit patreon.com/arthousegarage or find the link in the show notes to check those out. Okay, back to the show.
There's a weird kind of dissonance in this movie. You have, like, Cronenberg is such a classical filmmaker, which is so weird for an art filmmaker, you know what I mean? Like, we usually think about art filmmakers as people who come up with really fascinating compositions and complex camera moves. I was talking to Philip about this the other day. It almost looks like every shot from a Cronenberg movie is from a graphic novel or something like that. I was reading the great critic Amy Tobin recently, who had a great insight that Cronenberg's movies never really did well at the box office when they first came out, and so they made the bulk of their profit from home video, right? From VHS tapes that nerdy kids in the 90s watched while their parents were away, like me, right? And so she has this idea that he started composing all of his images for the small screen, which means that a lot of his films are close-ups, right? He loves the human face. A majority of this movie is shot super, super close so that we really get to interact with the characters, which I think is really fascinating. It's, that's another thing that I think throws all this production design into the background. Even though we see all the grime, we see all the landscapes, the empty walls, the bookshelves, the boxes, he's first and foremost committed to human beings and faces. I think he would rather shoot a face than anything else, even, you know, organs being removed from a human body.
Yeah.
And almost shoot a face in the most boring way possible. I'm not concerned with you thinking about this film stylistically. Here's the shot that I need for two of my characters to talk philosophically about what it means to mutilate yourself in front of a group of people while they film it. I parallel this so much to Lynch, and I think those two go hand in hand with this. Auteur filmmakers whose works progressively started building such a style that it's hard to ignore Cronenberg film when it comes out, or Lynch film when they used to come out. I think the same thing, and I want to bring up this of the actors. I was joking about Kristen Stewart's portrayal in this, and I think she did a great job, but it's such a Cronenberg way to act that you cannot separate what she's doing in it of just in the film. She's very uncomfortable, and it seems like in a very Cronenberg way, uncomfortable with her body as a bureaucrat who can only think politically, socially, and can't think aesthetically about her own body. And so she's all nervous, and she has this, I almost burst out laughing when I saw it in the theater. She has this point where she just pops down to talk to Viggo Mortensen, who's sitting. And it's just, it's comedic. It's like something out of a comic book of just the way you would expect a jester to just pop down and talk to the king. And what do we do with the actors throughout Cronenberg films and the way in which, I don't think that it's, we look at a shot and say that's a Cronenberg shot. Maybe we can do that with some like Lynchian imagery of like, oh, that's a curtain, you know, oh, that's a blue light. But I think what makes the Cronenberg scene so Cronenberg-ish is the way in which he gets his actors to have some sort of relationship with their bodies. Of, are they very comfortable with it? Are they agonizing in pain because they're creating new organs in this movie? Are they a nervous bureaucrat who can't even control their own body and don't really know how they're supposed to perform in this body? What makes a Cronenberg film a Cronenberg film? What makes Crimes of the Future Cronenberg-ish?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And I was actually going to talk about the, ask you guys about the performances. And yeah, Kristen Stewart is so, and it's funny because she has a little bit as a performer of a reputation of being kind of fidgety and awkward. And this just dials that up so much. So she, like the scene in which she's kind of coming on to him in her office, she's just like so, so over the top. You can tell she's so uncomfortable. And a couple of scenes in the film, a character says something like, I was basically like their desire was awakened and they were very surprised by that. And you can tell she especially is just like, I don't know what to do with this. And yeah, I thought that was a good, maybe a divisive performance. I don't know. I thought I really liked her in this, but what do y'all think about Viggo Mortensen and Léa Seydoux?
Well, I think they're great and they're always great. I'm with you on Kristen Stewart. I mean, that this is peak Kristen Stewart, in my opinion. But then again, I think it is a divisive performance, you know, just like Keira Knightley in Dangerous Method, which I think is maybe his most controversial performance. It really borders on bad acting. Maybe it is bad acting. Maybe it's intentionally bad acting. I don't know. But maybe I'm just such a fan of Kristen Stewart that I was willing to forgive the absolute absurdity of this performance. But I also think that it just resonates really beautifully for the reason that Philip was saying. She feels in a state of discomfort with her own body to the point where when she spits out words, I don't know how you get an actress to do that. Her level of enunciation, having words coming out of the very like tip of her teeth, every line, it takes skill. I will say that it's a skilled performance, you know. But I don't know, I love Viggo Mortensen, and mostly I love his commitment to David Cronenberg and the fact that they've worked together so many times, and he respects Cronenberg so much and his ideas and his worldview and is willing to morph every time. And I think when you look at a movie like History of Violence, in which he's this all-American guy who also has a dark side, and then Eastern Promises, in which he's a Russian gangster, and then this film in which he seems to be like an alter ego for Cronenberg, this sort of aging man in total discomfort with his body, and also has a great sense of humor. I mean, like, I was surprised by how hilarious his character was in this movie, walking around in this monastic cape and then just sort of looking at people with this kind of constant expression of, what are you talking about? Like, I mean, whatever. I'm just a guy pulling out my organs. Like, why are you making, like, he's funny, like, throughout the entire film. And I think just the diversity of his performances in those movies shows his commitment to the ideas of Cronenberg. I like to believe that they're super good friends. I don't see any other way.
Yeah, I want to talk about Viggo Mortensen too. I thought he was so good in this, and yeah, so many close-ups, as you said, Philip, like, just we get a lot of his face in this. And I think you need an actor for this role that is like, he's coughing half the time in the movie, like he's just wheezing and like can barely get things. So he's like in physical pain, and there's something hard to watch about that. But then at the same time, he has this sex appeal too that I haven't seen just a ton of his movies. But I was talking to my wife, I was like, he was really sexy in this, which is so weird because he, I can't remember exactly what I was going to say, but just, you know, a few of the characters in the film say something about like, I'm surprised that I was turned on by this or found this erotic. That's kind of how I felt about the movie. It's like, why am I finding this so sexy? This is like, it's so weird. But I mean, and Lea Seydoux, of course, is gorgeous as well. And so I think the eroticism of really of the film comes from those two primarily. So yeah, I thought he was great in this.
Well, I think that's absolutely the point, right? To confront you with your own desires, right? It's a transgressive movie. It's designed to make you uncomfortable. And I think the audience that is not intended for this film are people that are going to go in and think, no, I have a rigid understanding of sexuality, eroticism, attraction, and all of this kind of stuff. But to have a filmmaker confront you with, this is extremely weird. It's kind of messed up. Also, is there maybe a little bit of sexiness to it? I think that is the point where we can stop disavowing all of these kind of maybe ugly functions of the human body and start to understand ourselves and how we work as human beings. And I'm totally with you. I mean, I think Viggo Mortensen's performance is so human, and he manages to just bring a life, a sense of humanity, kindness, levity to a movie that otherwise might just be purely intellectual. You know, he makes us relate to the film.
Well, that's great. Well, a question I was planning to ask earlier, which we have kind of gotten into already, but if you have anything to add, just thematically, there's a lot of different things going on in this. You know, there's political stuff, the violence, the kind of nature of bodies you've been talking about, sexuality and desire. Is there anything that stood out to you? Anything else that we haven't talked about thematically that you wanted to get into?
I was telling Mark, we went and saw it, and I walked out of the theater, and I remember back when they came out with a film adaptation of The Cherry Orchard way back when, and I was watching it, and I was in high school, and I was like, what in the world is this? And finally, I was walking out bewildered. My dad said, it's a metaphor for the history of Russia. And then I went, oh, yeah, that's the communists. That's the, you know, oh, okay, you know, it's the Bolsheviks. I get it. And I was feeling that way while I was watching Crimes of the Future. And I did not believe that Cronenberg, because he has never really done this, I did not believe that he would give just scene by scene, you're lost, you're lost, you're lost, you're lost. You know, even in things, you know, a little bit more absurd, like Videodrome, Dead Ringers, we have a sense of what's going on and where the plot's going and why these characters are saying the things that they're saying and what the world is. There was a scene in which Viggo Mortensen was speaking, and he was talking about what he creates. And that's when it kind of clicked for me that my big theory is that this is a almost character for character. Everyone is an allegory for Cronenberg's films, having put out these multiple films. The organs that he creates are the films. And as disgusting as they are, he finds an audience underground with a community who likes what he's doing. He even compares himself to other, you know, creators who aren't maybe doing things that are as astounding as they look, like the ear person. You have the Academy Awards allegory of, well, we'll put you in the awards, you know, and I bet you could win. And he's like, I don't think I'm going to win a thing for inner beauty. And then you have the most just group of American men who come towards the third act, who say, we're actually eating on plastic these days. We're, you know, and yeah, I think it was a nice critique of American cinema, you know, blockbusters, where it's at. I'm literally getting my son to eat plastic. Isn't that great? You know, this is what the future is. And then finally, he kind of makes you in the third act, which he usually does this in his films, of maybe you kind of start seeing that there should be a limit to this somewhere. There should be a moralizing limit that says, okay, I should be able to do this, but at what point do we finally say no? At what point do we allow, you know, the character in Videodrome to just completely go unhinged? At what point in Cosmopolis does it matter that the billionaire, trillionaire is just shooting people in the street? I I think he always kind of comes back to kind of a conservative ideology towards the end of his films. And so if for anybody listening who like hasn't seen it, I would ask you to like watch it in terms of how is Cronenberg talking about what it means to create maybe not only films, but a work of art, and how are you seen by others for that?
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. I mean, I think the big argument that the movie is, I mean, it's obviously about art making, right? I think this is a movie that does a couple of things. It damns our contemporary culture for its lack of care about the environment. I mean, it's an environmentalist movie, right? It has those aspects of body horror and a whole lot of contemporary political resonances. I think in a lot of ways it's a queer film, for instance. Mm-hmm. I think in a lot of ways it's a film about government control of people's bodies, right? Mm-hmm. But also it's a movie that he very specifically chose to be about performance artists. Like, it didn't have to be a film about the creation of art. But he asks this really interesting question, which is, at what point is art art? At what point is art valid? A man stands up at one point and criticizes his artistic process of removing these organs that he apparently wills to exist, and says, I have a tumor here on my abdomen. Is that art? Am I Duchamp? Am I Picasso? Mm. Etc. Right? And I think to Philip's point about this idea of plastic and Hollywood movie making, when we think about movies, usually everything is very external, not personal. The idea is, what does the audience want, and what can I manufacture? Mm-hmm. The audience wants the next Marvel movie. Here's the formula with which we can create that. It has nothing to do with me. It did not come from within me. This mm-hmm. is just a product that I'm making. Yeah. The same as the plastics that we throw into the ocean and ultimately consume, and there's microplastics in all our blood and whatever, right? But I think his argument is, where does this process start, right? It starts from within us. He is a man who has these like weird tumors growing inside of him, which I think, you know, it's kind of cute, but Philip is right. Like, those tumors are maybe a representation of all of his individual films. There are mm-hmm. these things that grew organically within him and then have to be removed. The ideas themselves are not the art. The tumors themselves are not the art, but it's the public display. Right. Mm. The removing of it and the recording of it and the showing it in these underground landscapes that makes something real art, not plastic art, but this thing that comes from within you that's then removed and given to the public. It's honestly a kind of beautiful metaphor for a film so ugly, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. And then it's well, the human body wasn't made to digest this plastic art, right? So we'll alter ourselves, dumb ourselves down maybe to be able to do it, and then pass that on to our kids as well. And yeah, that's a great reading of that, that I didn't fully capture, but yeah, go ahead.
And they even call it a miracle. They say, no, he's the miracle child. And what an abhorrent miracle it is that we can feed our children the plastic that we've produced for them now, you know, whether you take that literally or allegorically in the film. It works, and that was kind of the big fearful moment where, what do you do with the cause? You know, is this something to stand for or not?
Yeah.
Were there any political or contemporary issues that the movie was dealing with, Andrew, that kind of piqued your interest?
Yeah, well, I always think about religious themes and things. So I've done a series of podcast episodes actually about just having conversations with people like myself who grew up very staunchly fundamentalist evangelical and have since broken free of that, and finding those kinds of themes in movies. So anytime there's a character like Viggo Mortensen in this, who I think there's a little bit of an ideological battle within him, like we have all these different factions, some of whom are embracing the change and some of whom are shutting it down. And he is sort of in the middle. And maybe this is a good point to talk about the ending, I think. So spoiler warning, we're going to talk about the ending and some of the things that happened there. If you haven't seen the film, highly recommend you go check it out. So, all right, from here on, spoilers. But we find out that he's sort of playing both sides, that he's an informant for the police. And that, so we have some groups saying, okay, the human body is changing. We need to embrace this. We need to figure out how to work with this. And as an artist, he is in a position to, like, he's showing this off, like, my body's doing this, and let's look at this and celebrate it. But then we find out he actually is trying to destroy them. Like, he wants to stop it in a way. And like, he is helping the police because he wants them to, he wants to help their cause of sort of, you know, keeping normal human beings normal. And so then in the ending, which I thought the final shot was so incredible. Again, it's a close up of his face. We get that kind of different visual representation. She has this handheld camera. It's actually on her finger. And we've seen it once before, but it's a striking difference suddenly. And then we have this, like, perfectly placed tear as he's just eaten the plastic. And it's in a way it feels like he's in that moment became a true believer. That's how I read it anyway. It's like he's kind of torn between these two things, and then here he is embracing one on the other, and it's, you know, embracing the plastic. So maybe that's the horrific ending, that it's like, oh no, it's a tragic ending. That's just my reading of it. I'm curious to hear what y'all think, and it may be very different, but yeah, I'm always thinking about the just wrestling with belief and that experience. That was what I was thinking about watching this.
I think it's totally religious. I think you're absolutely right, because Vigo, just like these agencies, is holding on to an idea that there is a true human, right? That there is right and wrong. That there is a right way for human beings to be and a wrong way for human beings to be, and that there is a classical human and maybe a degenerate human, right? And I think maybe for a long time he was attached to this idea of remaining classical and kind of removing the degenerate qualities and giving them to the public so that he could remain human. And I also think that's totally natural. You know, as Caprice says in the movie, who wouldn't remove these tumors? They're potentially dangerous. They're scary, right? Mm-hmm. They're all of those things that maybe a religious, conservative, classical culture would say, get this out of you, you know? Mm-hmm. I think the end of the movie is really provocative, because it does kind of suggest that he's come to terms with the fact that eating plastic and developing a digestive tract that can handle plastic is okay. But on a greater and maybe more metaphorical level, it suggests the fact that maybe our idea of what a human body is not gospel, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe my body is something that exists in time. Maybe my body is something that has needs at a given moment, and maybe I can fulfill those needs. I think you're on the money. Philip, what do you think about all that?
We were talking, you know, earlier about how, okay, the idea of him being a performance artist, it didn't have to be that. Mark was saying that. And I think in the same way, it didn't have to be a candy bar. You know, the symbol for this sort of eating plastic that is killing some people, we see, you know, early in the film, somebody die when they eat it. So it's setting us up to think, is Vigo going to die? Has he actually built, because he asked the question, well, can these organs actually become their own system? And so there's this assumption, okay, did he actually develop the digestive system that will save him when he eats this candy bar, or will he not? That's how I interpreted it. And I think the candy bar is the, you know, the trash food that we eat, that I definitely consumed while watching the film, which I don't recommend eating whole medium popcorn and a hot dog while watching Crimes of the Future. It's a bad idea. Nevertheless, I know this is a Crimes of the Future podcast, but my third Lynch reference is that Lynch has a symbol for this too, which is, you know, the cream corn, which he considers pain and suffering, even says it's pain and suffering. It's the popcorn that we consume. It's a popcorn film. This is the candy bar film, you know, of like these Americans want to feed us with these plastic films that don't do anything good for us. And we just eat this trash. I think it's... he's subverting his own statement and is saying maybe there actually is a place for this. And if me as Cronenberg can't survive in this landscape, then who am I to call myself a filmmaker? And so I hopefully have, and this is very punny, which I think Cronenberg and Lynchy are getting very punny with their symbols as they get older. Does he have the stomach to handle working in this landscape anymore? If he's inundated with these, you know, this is the future, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I would say also, there's really no indication of what happens to him at the end. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure. Maybe there's a tear shed in that beautiful black and white close up that suggests, oh, I'm nourishing the body that I hadn't nourished because I have been ignoring its evolution. But also maybe it's that beautiful religious tear shed when you see the white light in front of you and you realize that it's all over. I mean, I agree with you, Philip, but I also like I think that there's like an ambiguity there. Like I'm not sure about that.
It now that you say that, especially like recalling the black and white, it's very reminiscent of Joan of Arc, right? You know,
that martyr thought
coming down. In black and white, and perhaps, you know, the fact that he's being filmed and it's suddenly shot on this kind of grainy, you know, somewhat antiquated black and white look. Is this not his reflection on all films of that there has been a progression through cinema that every other, you know, someone who's being kind of stalwart has said, no, we can't go that far. You know, we should not be going into this direction. And he's saying, well, ever since the beginning. You know, I think there's a way to interpret that black and white scene as since, because it's silent too, right? You know,
Andrew, I'm curious, as a lover of faith-based films, and I know you do a lot of podcasts about them. You've talked about a lot of my favorite movies that I think are like the most humanist movies of all time, Breaking the Waves, an ugly movie that also has a lot of heart. Winter Light, a movie about a very cold man who has a great awakening. And I think you loved Memoria last year, if I remember correctly. This is a really, really ugly movie. And I think that would scare a lot of people away. But I think it's in a lot of ways, a really lovely and spiritual movie. On the level of just like kindness and good vibes, did you get any of that from this movie, or did you leave it the theater kind of in a state of despair?
That's a good question. I was definitely, again, like being a relative newcomer to Cronenberg, I was definitely in like a little bit of state of shock. But it was like I heard the things about, oh, people are walking out of this movie in the first 5 minutes, which we haven't even talked about that opening scene, which is really hard to watch and has this infanticide happening. And we don't understand why, as you said earlier, Philip, like it's not explained until much later in the film. But so, yeah, there definitely was like I went in with some trepidation, but it was easier to watch than I expected. And again, like even the really violent scenes have a beauty to them. And that's, you know, that's part of the point of it. But yeah, I definitely it was. In a way, it was more traditional than I expected. And like you said earlier, too, like he's a bit more of a classical filmmaker than I kind of expected going in as well. So it was, I think I had my guard up like, oh, this is going to be really gross and terrible. And it was gross, but it was, I think the thematic things going on were easy enough to latch onto that it was not that it was a super easy film. I think it's definitely one that demands pretty close scrutiny and obviously, as we've talked about, has lots of different things you can interpret out of it. But it was something that I ended up coming away like that was actually really beautiful, especially I think ending on the image that we end on too. I thought it was just so striking and And yeah, definitely had a spiritual resonance that I'm still working through and kind of figuring out. But especially after talking to you guys about it, I've really got to go see it again on the big screen and key into some of these other things. But yeah, I would say to anyone who is super, you know, put off by the idea of some of the things you've heard about this film, it is some of those things, but it also, I think it's going to be really rewarding probably for anyone who can stomach it.
Maybe the most shocking thing about it is that in a movie that's all about cutting up human bodies, mostly it's just people talking about the human experience, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm glad you're open to seeing it again. I think I'll probably go for round three sometime this week.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on the podcast. This has been a great discussion. I really appreciate it. And we'll absolutely have to have you back, maybe with Cronenberg's next one or before that too. But I have really enjoyed talking to you today. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Huge thanks to Mark and Philip for doing the heavy lifting on this episode. I really loved talking to them and listening to what they had to say about this film. Coming up on the show, we are doing a couple of episodes for Pride Month. So next week, filmmaker Evelyn Landau is returning to the show, and she has selected the excellent film Everything Everywhere All at Once. I love that film, and I'm excited she chose it. It wasn't one that I considered for Pride Month, but it certainly has some strong queer themes. So very excited for that one. The following week is TBD. It may be a new film, it may be another Pride episode, or we may finally get to finish out the film noir series with the discussion of Chinatown. It will be one of those things. Stay tuned. And with that, thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. We have a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. You can learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, become a patron over at patreon.com/arthousegarage or find a link in the show notes. You can also buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. And if you want to support us without spending any money, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app. And that is hugely helpful. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter at arthousegarage.com/subscribe, or you can always email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.